Welcome to Making Sheffield, celebrating the Steel City's history and heritage. Our guest today is historian and author David Templeman.
The actual remit was to keep her in custody, locked away and be forgotten about. That's what they thought would happen. But Mary, of course, never let up with her intrigue letters. France, this scattergun approach, she was a thorn in the side all the time. She would never just lie down and just fade into the background, which that's what they wanted, that she'd be forgotten about. And, oh, she's locked away, you forget it. But she didn't. She just never let up. So she was a massive thorn in Elizabeth's side, massive thorn in her side. She was put under, of course, the custodianship of George Talbot, the 6th Earl of Shrewsbury, and Bess of Hardwick. Well, they had 9 properties, remember. 9 properties. And they would use 7 of them to put Mary in, to rotate them round while they cleanse them and for security and that. But the main base for the Shrewsburys was Sheffield. In fact, this one, Manor Lodge, was a brand new manor house for them, and it was a great spot, you know, this wonderful deer park, one of the largest private deer parks in the country, 8 miles in circumference, probably 3,000 deer in here at its zenith, and some of them, the great oak trees ever recorded in England were in this park. And you've got this wonderful vantage point, 360 degrees, looking down, Sheffield nestling in the bottom, the deer, the great oak trees, the Peak District in the distance. And of course, the great advantage of Sheffield is you've got 2 properties within 2 miles. You've got the castle, which was virtually impregnable at the time because of its vast moat round it and 6-foot thick walls where they could put her in there. And then when it's a bit more lenient, bring her up here and they can enjoy the sunshine and the fresh air and that up here. Just going down a beautiful avenue of walnut trees between the two of them. Totally enclosed, so nobody could use it. And they had this lovely avenue of walnut trees which went down the line of City Road today, just this side, and down to the Park Square roundabout, where that is. That was where the park gate was. Come out of the castle, down Dixon Lane, and then straight across where the Park Square roundabout is today would be the park gate, through the park gate, and then straight up this lovely avenue of walnut trees. So this was absolutely perfect for them. They got a lovely place to come to, and then they could go to the castle. She could be in the castle, closely guarded. Well, she was closely guarded up here, but virtually impregnable, the castle. And that was the main place they wanted to get her to, because she'd already had loads of escape attempts prior to coming to Sheffield. That's why Shrewsbury was banging on his table all the time. These are on 45 manor houses we're in at the moment, and she could escape at any moment in time. The only place I can guarantee her security is Sheffield Castle. And of course, eventually, Elizabeth relented, Elizabeth I relented and said, look, you've already had 2 recorded ones, and there probably would have been more. We can't just verify them, that's all. And just get her there. We can't risk it anymore. Of course, when you say that she was here 14 years, it like staggers people, and then they want to know more and more and more. And I never, ever intended writing a book, I can tell you that. But I did decide, down the line, I'll do it. So after 12 years of research as well, I got round to doing it. And then, of course, it has taken off, really, because I mean, it has filled an enormous gap in that part of the history of Mary Queen of Scots. Not just us locally, but nationally, of course. And of course, the big thing is that we've had a better access to letters. It's all about getting hold of the letters. There's thousands. I mean, she wrote over 2,000 letters in captivity. 2,000. And that's on the low side. So those are the ones we know about. She was smuggling out here, of course, intrigue letters in the heels of the shoes and olives of the staff and hairdressing things and smuggling them out all over the time to get over to France and Spain, you know, come and get me out sort of thing. But getting access to the letters, which, of course, have come online. You can get all of the Bess of Hardwick letters now. The Talbot letters from the Norfolks, they're available now. And it's so much easier to get all of the letters. And once you've got all of the letters, that you're away and running. She used a scattergun approach. She just sent out, this is why I'm saying that she wrote over 2,000 letters. She did a scattergun approach. She wrote to anybody and everybody who she thought could have, you know, that one person out of all this lot could come to her aid. So there was no real, you know, no real criteria what she'd actually aim, you know, one person, I should say. It was, that was it, right across the board. She came here with just thought like the other one. She'd been there 6 months, maybe. Wingfield 6 months, Chatsworth 6 months, something like that. And probably thought 6 months, be on to another one. They've got 9 properties, you know, the Shrewsbury's, 9 properties. I mean, the Shrewsbury's were a bit lucky to get, well, not lucky. They wanted to get rid of her, of course. They wanted to give it up. But of course, the big thing with Elizabeth being so miserly with the Privy Purse is that she was letting Shrewsbury pick up the bills, and it virtually nearly sent him bankrupt. Because she had to be kept in the manor of a queen. It's not locked up in her room. She had the whole royal court with her. She had 40 to 50 people with her, you know, cooks, ladies in waiting, grooms, doctors, everything you got. And totally separate to the Shrewsbury household. So Shrewsbury's looking after 2 households. He's supposed to have got £52 a week to look after her. In the manor of a queen. And she's got 40 to 50 people with her. You know, and she's got the meals in the manner of a queen, and 16 course meals 4 times a day. I don't think there was much love lost between the 2 households either. You can imagine that one might take a bit umbrage about that the one's getting better treated than we are, you know, and they're prisoners sort of thing. You can imagine that going off, can't you? And once he started, once he did try and cut down on it, well, she objected to Elizabeth, and he was in, you put those meals back. She used to be kept in the manner of a queen. They said to France and Spain, look, we've got your Catholic queen, which was Queen of France, of course, and Queen of Scotland. But Elizabeth petrified, of course. I mean, we were only a very small, fledgling Protestant country at the time. The Catholics ruled most of Europe, were massively powerful. They could gobble up England as a stroke. So Elizabeth had to tread very carefully. So she had to say to them, look, we're keeping your Catholic queen in custody, but in the manner of a queen. She's entitled to her court, and ambassadors could come to see her, red carpet out, you know, sort of thing, and all the fixtures and fittings, you know, appropriately like that. That was the sop they gave to her. So she didn't want to alienate them at all, because it might rebound back on her. That was the thinking behind it. But the big thing is, what she didn't realise is that France and Spain, which are the 2 main Catholic countries, I mean, she'd been Queen of France, Spain was a great Catholic power, they did nothing to help her, nothing at all. She thought they were helping her, they didn't help her at all. They got different issues, of course. The French were trying to get on good terms with the English at the time. Spain had got great issues. They were fighting in the Protestants in the Holland, you know, because there was a big push for Protestant religion then. The Huguenots in France and all that. And so they had other issues. And Mary, no, just put it one side. Too difficult. She's entombed there, and it means fighting a war with England over it. No, we don't want to get involved in that. She read a lot. She wrote a lot, as we know. She wrote a hell of a lot. But she was very good at poetry, by the way. There's a book of poetry still survives in Scotland, what she did. And this is only a limited number, but she was very good on poetry. But and they used to play the lute, like a guitar instrument, the lute instrument. She loved music, she loved dancing, she loved music. Of course, she didn't get great advantage of that, but you can imagine them sat in the room playing the lute and listening to the music while they're doing. But of course, her main thing was embroidery. It was all about embroidery. She'd been trained in France, of course, very, very skilled. You think Bess was good at embroidery, Bess of Hardwick, but She weren't as good as Mary. But the two, of course, combined, Mary and Bess, spent many hours together doing embroidery. They'd have a team of embroiderers with them. They were close to start with, right, very close. In fact, she really probably took over the mother, you know, like a mother, because there's quite a difference in age between them. What would it be, 15 years? No, it won't be the mother, but she was the senior one, of course. They got on very well to start with, but then the granddaughter of Bess came on the scene, Lady Arbella Stewart, who came from Mary's mother, married twice. So Arbella came on the other side, and she was virtually the same line up to the throne as Mary was. Well, Bess, this is Bess's granddaughter. Why would you want to be friendly with your chief rival? You want to get your granddaughter to be the next Queen of England here. And of course, the other big thing is that Bess got very jealous because Mary could twist the men on her little finger. She got a very good, she was one of the great beauties of Europe. And she really had a great penchant for the men. Not to have affairs with them, but to just you know, draw them in and spit them out, sort of thing. And of course, George Talbot fell for it, hook, line and sinker. Because Bess was a busy woman, she was here, there and everywhere. I'm not saying she did it deliberate, but of course he was spending more time with Mary than anyone else. And his troubles, she would sit and listen to them and give him her advice, and, you know, he really thought it wonderful, Bess, you know. And she got totally jealous of her. Like I say, it would never have happened. Mary's done this many times before. She got no need to get involved with him on an affair basis at all. None at all. She spent some of each of the 14 years at the castle at some points, but not, you know, maybe months, couple of months. She didn't come up here until she'd been at the castle for 3 years. So it was 1570, she came up here in April 1573. So she was 2.5 years behind. It was nearly 2.5 years behind the castle. But in length then, she would spend more time up here. So when I've done it very approximately, I think it's about 50-50. You know, although it's only 11 of the 14 years at Manor Lodge, as against 14 in the castle, those extra weeks or months would add up to about the same. Our thinking is the ceiling in the main, got a fantastic embellished ceiling in the main room at the top left-hand corner as you look at it, is really out of sync, because you would, in a turret house or a hunting tower, they're just plain fretwork ceilings, just a plain ceiling. It's got a terrific patterns and everything. So it had to be high status. But we think it was a high status, banqueting room, you know, for the, well, probably the dessert course of the meal. They used to take them in separate rooms or separate buildings. And of course, what they used to do in those, these, like at the Stand Tower at Chatsworth and North East Hall at Hathersage, they'd have a flat roof, they'd go up and take the views in. And it was like, and then come down and have a buffet set out. And it was all about that, I would have thought. But what I think, because she was quite friendly, she was godmother to the grandchildren of the Shrewsburys. So she was quite involved with the family at one, certainly for quite a long period, is that they would take her across on these things, because she's in the confines of the, you know, the walls. She's not outside it, she's inside it. It's part of the complex. And do that, because what we found in that ceiling is the thistles of Scotland, the fleur-de-lis of France, which she was queen of, and these are all right at the very end, as she came late in the day, as if she said, right, we're going to put your stuff in it. I don't think they would have put them in there if she hadn't been some sort of involvement in that room. I mean, the Victorians are adamant that that was a prison room, you know, they kept her there. But first of all, why would you want to put her on the outer boundary? If you were keeping a prisoner, you wouldn't ever put her on the outer boundary, right on the outside boundary of a complex. And secondly, she's got 40 people maybe at that time. They would have to come all across from the main house to there and go back again. Because only small rooms, you know. And we do know from the 1582 inventory that she had her whole complex rooms in the main house. Because it says Queen's kitchen, Queen's chamber, Queen's bedroom. We don't know exactly where they were, by the way, because it's all written text. But they were in the main house. But we think she would have come across and taken, certainly, the advantage of going on the flat roof, taking the fresh air and that in on there and with the family. I'm afraid the lodge was a victim of an absentee landlord. and, you know, I don't mind naming the Duke of Norfolk because the present Duke of Norfolk apologised last time for his ancestors, what they'd done. They should never have let it go. Because it was just free gratis, really. You come, you know, to the people in Sheffield, like the cutlers and that, you come up here and help yourself to the bricks. It was good for buffing cutlery, the bricks up here. Tudor bricks, these were really great Tudor bricks. It's the same as Hampton Courts, 2¼-inch wide ones, the Royal Palace bricks. And they would come up in carts and take stuff away, you know, it was just free gratis all the time. Yet the turret house, which has survived, they spent many, many years here restoring it in the 1870s and restored it back to its roots, and that's why it's in very good condition. So the only roof building here is probably the only one Mary would recognise if she came back in the present day, because all the others have gone. Well, like any prisoner of any kind would tell you, the lack of fresh air and lack of, you know, exercise, that was the two main problems. Because she was a terrific sports gladiator girl. When she was Queen of Scotland and Queen of France, she would ride out every single day as a queen. Terrific horse rider. She didn't wear the long skirt and dainty side saddle thing. She wore men's breeches, rode over the saddle, and could outride most of the men. She was the first lady ever recorded to play golf at St Andrews. She played real tennis, croquet, archery, a whole caboodle of it. So somebody who's a sporting prowess to be confined, because virtually borders on the line of solitary confinement. You know, I know she got a lot of the trappings of a queen, but you're still confining someone. You cannot go out through those gates. You walk around the grounds and that, you cannot go out through those gates. The only time she ever went through those gates was if they were going to Chatsworth or Buxton or these other places, when they went out like a summer sojourn, then came back to base Sheffield again. Shrewsbury had gotten quite ill, very ill. I was in no state to look out. Now, the marriage had fallen apart. Like I say, Bess had had enough. He wouldn't stand up to Elizabeth. She was shortchanging him. They were desperate for money, and she was, you know, the bitter enemies by this time, Mary and Bess. So she bobbed off back to Chatsworth, which where her family was out there. Her family was out there at Chatsworth. And she went off there. And they never got divorced, but they were what we call estranged, right? But to be fair to Bess, she tried everything in the book to get back with Tom. But Shrewsbury, I think, had a mini stroke in 1578. His writing was never, ever very good. But after that, it was virtually illegible. You could hardly read it. And he was blaming Elizabeth for all his troubles up to then, which rightly it was, you know, shortchanging and all this stuff. But then he switched over to blaming his wife, with Bess all the time. He was absolutely adamant that Bess was the one behind everything and her two sons, spreading rumours about this, you know, this so-called affair and all this stuff. You've got no proof of it. And so Bess, of course, spent a lot of time in Sheffield looking after Mary and did a good job, but she's no longer there. Shrewsbury's on his own looking after her, and his health had plummeted after 1578, plummeted. And she was having a birthday, plotting these new ventures now. She was coming down the at the corner where we call Wolsey's Tower, we think it was that, because it was taken away at Queen's Tower. Queen's Tower took that section away in the 1800s. It was Samuel Roberts, who was commemorated in Sheffield Cathedral. He was a massive Mary Queen of Scots fan. And he took the window and the section of the wall, and I don't think he had permission for it, by the way, but he took it up to Queen's Tower and oh, we'll look after it for all time. Well, they did, but the family died out. And then, guess what? Private flats, oh, we've lost it, we've lost it. But that was a well-recorded escape attempt at Sheffield Manor. A great plot in 1583, the year before she left Sheffield, which precipitated the move, was the Throckmorton plot, Spain to invade, kill Elizabeth, and the Privy Council, and put Mary on the throne of England. And this was all planned from Sheffield, a lot of it, because she's best weren't there. Shrewsbury was ill, virtually all the time. Oh, we're okay, we get letters out here, there and everywhere. Now, Elizabeth would always think, you know, great, Shrewsbury will look after her and pick up the bills and all this, but she had to face up to the fact she's got to go, otherwise it's going to bring the whole lot down on us. We only just got out of this Throckmorton lot by spy network working in on their behalf. So that was the deciding factor. And like I said, they took it away in 1584. And 2.5 years later, of course, she was involved in the Babington plot and was executed for high treason. Yeah, 27, 28 when she came here. She was 42 when she left, because she was executed at 44. It was only 2 years after leaving here she was executed, of course. If she kept at Sheffield, that may not have happened. Well, she went back on a reverse journey. She'd have started off at Tutbury in Staffordshire, just near Derby, 12 miles from Derby, and Wingfield, which is the other side of Chesterfield, South Wingfield. So she went back to them, South Wingfield, and then Tutbury. And then finished up at a new one called Chartley Manor, which is near Stafford. And that's where, well, the Babington plot started off at Tutbury and worked its way on to Tutbury, to Chartley. And they did an entrapment on her, and she walked into it, of course. She had desperation by then, goaded into it. Because if you think the Shrewsbury custodianship was bad, you've got nothing after it. This was much worse. It was much worse. Because the new custodian, Sir Amias Paulet, or Paulet, or whatever you want to pronounce it, he was given the thing, make life so much more difficult for her. Check every single thing. Everybody was searched. She'd got no outlet for getting her letters out. And then all of a sudden, a Catholic priest was introduced to her at Chartley, or probably at Tutbury, I can't remember, it was Tutbury maybe. And he said, oh, which was from a local family, and she checked him out. I mean, it was kosher, you know, no problem, trust him, you can trust him. And he said, I can get you the letters out. And they did it through an ingenious way from a brewer at Burton, where they put a leather pouch in the top of a keg and put the bung back. And he protected the letters and did it the reverse way around. And that was great, but what they didn't realise, this Catholic priest was in the Bay of Walsingham, the Spy Master General. He knew everything was going on. He was kosher, he was 100%, but he'd been arrested at Dover when he came in from these Jesuit priests, which had come to preach sedition against Elizabeth, and was arrested. And, of course, he was turned on the premise of, You've got two choices. We either execute you or you work for us. Which one do you want to do? He finished up, of course, getting in prison in France, and he died there. He died in prison. They got their own back on him in the end. He did it once too often. But again, who could she trust in captivity? She had to take these people more or less on face value. She had a secretary in Paris, which she would officially go through. But of course, they didn't know what anything would happen once they'd landed in England, like this bloke had, this chap had. She was an entrapment. And of course, then they were just pulling the strings after that. Goaded into her. And sure, she signed the Babington letter. She never signed anything like that in Sheffield. But because it was sheer desperation, and Babington, she knew him, He'd been at Sheffield since he was 12 years old as a young squire, so she could trust him. But what she, again, his circle, which were doing they were going to assassinate Elizabeth, by the way, again had been infiltrated by the spies. So they got spies in the Mary household, and they got spies in the Babington household as well. They were pulling the string, but so it was entrapment. Just, they needed Mary's signature agreeing that Elizabeth would be killed, and that's the only way Elizabeth would agree to execute her. She said, I'm never going to execute my cousin. She's a fellow monarch, of course. You know, you don't want to be executing a fellow monarch. You're setting a precedent for your own self. So, well, they had this divine right, of course, the monarchs, God's chosen people, God's anointed ones. To commit an act against a fellow monarch was an act against God. You know, I'm not committing Mary. I'm answerable to God if I kill her. She had to do in the end purely because of the evidence that was given to her. It's either you or her. She will have you killed. Which are you going to do? Because she could have had her executed here in Sheffield in 1572. The Duke of Norfolk, the big plot here, was the Ridolfi plot. It was in 9 months after coming here. That was a massive plot, which could have altered the whole course of English and European history, by the way. Spain was going to invade, kill Elizabeth and Privy Council, and put Mary and the Duke of Norfolk as monarchs of England. And it was very well planned. But again, the spy network sussed it out, and they got wind of it, and they infiltrated part of it, where the agent was going across to France from Dover, and got his pouch of diplomatic papers. Because Ridolfi was an Italian banker, but he was a diplomat as well, so he got sort of like immunity, but they knew that something was going off. So when they searched his papers, they were in code, but they broke the code. And of course then it all unravelled, and they broke it. But that was, so the Duke of Norfolk lost his head and lost the title of Duke of Norfolk until 1660. They didn't get it back for 100 years. They were called the Earls of Arundel. They went one step down then. But they got it back with Charles II time. But the one person who should have gone to the block with him was Mary, of course. She was equally as guilty. They got all the proof, they got all the letters and everything. But Elizabeth said to them, I am not executing my cousin. No way. I'll deal with it, but I'm certainly not chopping her head off. So she just put very tight measures up here in Sheffield. Household went from 40 to 50 down to 16. That was the lowest point, 16 people, that's all were allowed. But of course it did build back over the years, of course, when things started to improve. Went back to probably about 40-ish by the time she left again. So there were two real main plots went off. The Ridolfi about 1572, with the Duke of Norfolk lost his head, and Mary should have gone to the block. And 1583, the one, the Throckmorton plot, which was the final straw that Mary would have to be moved. It's not just an important piece of local history, which it is, but it's this very pivotal piece of English and European history. But then it even goes one stage further. It plays a very important part in the story of one of Britain's most romantic and tragic figures, which is Mary, Queen of Scots. It's 19 years, over 44 years, she was in captivity. 14 of them in Sheffield, which is nearly a third of her life, remember, were here. Escape attempt successful. She could have challenged Elizabeth easily. May have taken the throne off her. We would have had probably a civil war between the Catholics and the Protestants. We'd have had many of Spanish troops here. Who knows what could have happened? It was only probably down to two people, and that was Shrewsbury himself, who virtually sent himself bankrupt doing it. But he paid for 30 extra guards himself out of his own pocket, no need to have. And of course, obviously the spy master general, Walsingham, who had a terrific, well, through Cecil, of course, his boss, they're this great spy network, which was spies in France, in Spain, English towns, and, you know, the taverns and all this, all listening all the time. And that what saved Elizabeth, really. It saved her. But it was so close. Well, normally we open Sundays from April, which is beginning of April, through till end of September. We have three guided tours a day on every Sunday, normally. And people can book for tours in the week as well if they bring in a group of people, you know. like these history groups or WI or something like that. Because in the week up there, Monday to Friday, it's mainly for education. Schools come in, and so it's anybody can sort of book it for that sort of thing. Saturdays, weddings, of course, are taken over for using the turret house. So Sundays is really the only general purpose day. But we have quite a few special open days. We have this History Through the Ages in June normally, which is, you know, right through from the, you know, from the Norman times right through till Second World War II, a different reenactment group. We'll have probably six reenactment groups here taking over the whole site. The whole site comes to life, you know. It really is good. We use every bit of space we've got up there. We have the camps, the living camps, and demonstrations and all this stuff. So we have, you know, booster days to bring money in. So revenue is our thing. So we've got income streams coming in from weddings, and we've got these wonderful wildflower meadows here, of course, right through these 4-acre sites, you know, right from the Discovery Centre, right through down to where the crossroads at the bottom. All this side belongs to Sheffield Manor. So we grow our own turf and all that stuff down there now, and compost we do. Very much a green, you know, green roofs, things of this nature are done here. You know, they go out and do contracts and things of that nature. So it's not just the history side. So we've got quite a few different income streams coming in, and which they do need. Yes, obviously heritage has never been a great profit earner for anyone. It's normally a loss leader. But it is so important, very much important, yeah, which you can never lose the track of this. And of course, this is what brought us to when I started in 2004. It went on BBC Two Heritage Series with Griff Rees-Jones. We beat hundreds of applicants from the north of England to get on there. And we got into the final three on the north. We didn't do anything, but because of the high profile we got, it meant that our bid to the Heritage Lottery Fund was successful. And we got about 1.6 million, something of that nature. And we've had a few tranches of 500,000 since. There must have been at least 2.5 million on this site through Heritage. But they do recognise this site as what it is. It's in their top echelon of projects, you know, as this great piece of English and European history. And again, going back to my book, this was all about the idea, just to get that over. Sheffield hardly gets a mention in the biographies of Mary. Probably 3 or 4 mentions, that's all. Yet she spent 14 years here. My book, it's got 122 pages on Sheffield. You know, because it's a chronological order, of course, and 122 pages. So the detail is now back. And that's what was missing. It needed the detail put in back. So I did the other parts as well, but of course it's mainly about that Sheffield history. And we sell it online, by the way. It's at on our website. We're doing this at $7.99 instead of $9.99 post-free. Of course, if you do it, order it on our web page, we get all the money. And it goes to the site. Just all, I don't take any money for it. All the money goes to the Friends of Manor Lodge, which is a registered charity. Yeah, online Zoom presentations we'll be doing with Sarah Griswood, the Royal Historian, Curator of the Royal Palaces, Tracy Bowman, and Nicola Tallis, who's one of the great up-and-coming historical stars at the moment in history. They've all, because they like to help Sheffield Manor, you know, they've all been here. We used to have, our great success here was the Alison Weir coach tours, which Alison Weir is probably the top, one of the top historians writing history books on the Tudors. And she had organised coaches, and mainly Americans. And they had this great, great itinerary of places to come to, all through north of England, Scotland and that. And they came here, and they allowed half a day. And the people, the Americans, were begging. They were supposed to be going to Chatsworth. We don't want to go to Chatsworth. We want to stop here the full day. We want to stop here the full day. And I think they voted us probably in the top. Certainly, we had some great reviews in here. Great reviews. And, you know, we were, because we play, what we do is role play. We haven't got the buildings here. So we've formed a drama, a little small drama group, Manor Lodge players. The three players are Mary, Queen of Scots. We have a young actress who plays her, who's, because Mary was 6 foot tall, you know. She was massively tall. Well, our reenactor is probably taller than that. He's about 6 feet one. And then we've got a great Bess of Hardwick, of course, and I play Shrewsbury. So, and it's this triangle, of course, which, you know, we do. And I use the letters and take the letters and put them in the plays. So they're not actually thought up. The text is actually in the plays we use. And they were gobsmacked because all they were doing is walking around these houses wherever they were going and never really getting the feedback of what was going on. But we were showing the characters for the first time and role-playing it for you, what was going off here and what happened and that. Oh, they were just, you know, open-mouthed at what we were doing to them. Yeah, we're proud of what we do here. And although I'm only a volunteer here, obviously I'm a guide here, and we've got a terrific team, both staff and volunteers. And I can't praise them enough. But we all, you know, we're all very much enthusiastic and committed to the cause. And that's what it's all about here. Because, like I said, we are lacking buildings, but we do make up for it in other ways.